Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Today, two recipes using chicken mushrooms, a favorite fungus of fall foragers. Also a story from Harvest Public Media's series about the impact runoff from farm fields has on our water supply.
If you could target just a few of these major producers and get them to do the right thing and have the people that are renting their land do the right thing, that's where you could be making some more difference.
Researchers are looking for solutions to the environmental disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. And then two young entrepreneurs and one landowner collaborate on a composting business. But first, food stories that we followed in the news. Here's Mark Chilla with details.
Next time you order wasabi on your sushi, Annie, know this. It's almost certainly not real wasabi. Somewhere between 90 and 95% of wasabi sold in restaurants is fake. It's just a mixture of horseradish, green food coloring, and dry mustard. Our blogger Taylor Killow wanted to learn more, so she wrote up this explainer. The flavor of real wasabi is extremely volatile and strongest in the first few minutes after exposure to air. It's described as less spicy than imitation wasabi, but simply sharp. The plant's rhizome is grated to produce a green paste. Even though both wasabi and horseradish belong to the mustard family, the process of growing each is radically different, with many calling wasabi the hardest plant to grow commercially. Wasabi grows wild exclusively in cold, rocky freshwater riverbeds. It takes 18 months and tremendous patience to grow wasabi plants. Because of its very precise needs, wasabi cultivation is a process that's nearly impossible to mechanize. It also pays well, and that's enough of a reason for some farmers to try the nearly impossible, like Brian Oates of Pacific Coast Wasabi. He spent 30 years developing the first commercial wasabi farm in North America, which now has locations in British Columbia, Michigan, Washington, and Oregon. The website prices the wasabi at $70 for half a pound. News from Pepsi this week. The soda company announced it will cut the sugar content of its drinks. According to a press release, by the year 2025, at least two-thirds of the drinks in its global beverage portfolio are expected to contain 100 calories or fewer from added sugar per 12-ounce serving. Currently, a 12-ounce can of Pepsi has 150 calories, all of which come from sugar. This news comes just weeks before voters in three California cities and Boulder, Colorado, will be voting on the proposed soda taxes in their communities. As NPR has reported, the soda industry is fighting to fend off these tax initiatives. The American Beverage Association spent more than $4.2 million in advertising to defeat a soda tax in Philadelphia. But voters there approved that measure last summer anyway. The industry says it has reserved about $9.5 million in airtime for ad buys in the San Francisco area aimed at defeating the measures there. And we've been seeing pictures all week of flooded pig farms in North Carolina, the result of heavy rainfall from Hurricane Matthew. Several thousand animals drowned. The Washington Post published aerial images that show that many lagoons that hold waste products from the farms have also been flooded. There is concern that the waste will seep into the groundwater on its way to the ocean. North Carolina has some 2,100 hog farms. We'll post updates about this story as the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality conducts tests in the coming weeks. You'll find our updates at Earth Eats on Twitter.
Okie dokie, Mark. It's been good.
Yep. Till next time.
When heavy rains wash through farm country, chemicals from agricultural fields spill into small tributaries and even make their way to the Gulf of Mexico. That's created an environmental disaster. For Harvest Public Media's special series, Watching Our Water, Christopher Husted reports on new research into combating the problem.
Researchers call it the dead zone, since many fish, shrimp, and crabs can't live near the mouth of the Mississippi River in the northern Gulf of Mexico. On a map, it's roughly the size of Connecticut and Rhode Island combined, more than 6,000 square miles, according to recent projections. Matt Rota is with the environmental group Gulf Restoration Network.
This dead zone forms because nitrogen phosphorus pollution flowing from agricultural fields, because we use it as fertilizer, flowing from sewage treatment plants, from concentrated feeding animal feeding operations, from industrial sources, flows down the Mississippi River.
As river water from Montana to Pennsylvania drains into the Gulf, massive amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus create blooms of algae. When the algae dies and drifts to the bottom, it sucks the oxygen out of the water, making the area inhospitable to seafood. It's called hypoxia. Federal officials planned to reduce the dead zone to about a third of its current estimated size by 2015. But in the face of a growing problem, they recently kicked that can down the road another 20 years.
If you could target just a few of these major producers and get them to do the right thing and have the people that are renting their land do the right thing, that's where you could be making some more difference.
Upstream farmers can't just stop using fertilizer and pesticides altogether without massive changes in our food system. So what can they do? Researchers are looking at two strategies they're testing in the Midwest to help mitigate the dead zone in the Gulf. The first, adding what's called a riparian buffer, planting vegetation along streams. Ranjith Uduwada, a professor at the University of Missouri, is trying to get farmers to add four kinds of plants to separate a cornfield from a water source.
Next to the stream, we'll have a fast-growing tree species that can tolerate water.
Like cottonwood.
Then next to that is a slow-growing, high-value trees.
Maybe black walnut.
Then shrubs and grasses.
Research shows these buffer zones filter the nitrogen or phosphorus runoff before it gets to the river. Ultimately, Uduwada says no farmer wants to contribute to pollution.
They know the benefits. Everybody knows benefits of buffers, water quality, soil quality, wildlife, everything.
He's studying whether it's economically feasible for farmers to add the extra lines of vegetation by selling the trees for lumber or the grass for biofuel. The second strategy to shrink the dead zone lies in restoring the river floodplains.
It's going to be a little bit loud.
On a hot September afternoon near Rocheport, Missouri, Rob Jacobson, a hydrologist with U.S. Geological Survey, guides a speedboat along the Missouri River. He says some of the most productive agricultural areas are located along big rivers in floodplains. Farmers raise crops there, add inputs, then a flood comes along.
So if there was, you know, anhydrous ammonia that had been applied to that field, if there was atrazine that had been applied to the field, or glyphosate, it'd have a pretty direct route into the river.
Jacobson says that's where reestablishing wetlands in the floodplains can help.
So there's a hope that some of that flooding of these floodplain wetlands would reduce nitrogen loads.
Where's that at now?
Yeah, this floodplain right here.
Jacobson points out the lush Overton Bottoms Conservation Area. Parts of it used to be farmland, but conservation officials have been moving the levees back and returning it to its original form as a floodplain wetland. The native plants here, like the riparian buffer, can act as a filter for chemicals flushing down the river. But while Jacobson says these wetlands help denitrify the water, it's, well, only a drop in the bucket.
What we see here at Overton and these conservation lands would have to be replicated through most of the river valley to really have an effect on the amount of nitrogen that's in the system right now.
Until then, Jacobson says he hopes more federal programs and conservation efforts can incentivize farmers and landowners upstream on the river to protect the water downstream in the Gulf. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media has also produced a TV documentary about cleaning up our water. Find that and all five parts of this series at harvestpublicmedia.org.
Well, we've got some chicken of the woods mushrooms. These are, they really do have the taste and texture of chicken.
You're right.
Aren't those delicious? What we do is we braise them. A lot of other mushrooms you wouldn't add this much liquid to, but these kind of slow cook, and they can tend to be a little bit dry, but when you cook them in a little bit of chicken stock or a little bit of vegetable stock, they absorb the moisture. You can finish it with a little bit of butter. And they have this really nice bright yellow bottom and kind of an orangey lobster shell colored top.
and they keep in the refrigerator quite well for a week or two. So if you're lucky enough to find them, you can keep them around. You can also braise them off and freeze them and save them for Christmas time. So that's what I love to do, is to, you know, gather these things throughout the year, and then during December is the time to celebrate. And luckily, you know, I can cook pretty well, so people like to come visit. These were found by a guy who called me and said, what do I do with these mushrooms? So I told him, and he said, well, you know, it seems like a lot of work. Why don't you just have them? So I said, yeah, I'll take them.
It's so good to have friends.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Throughout the year, different people call me. They'll have a tree full of cherries, or a churchyard had a pear tree in it and nobody wanted the pears. So, you know, I was serving churchyard pears at the restaurant. So a lot of fun. These are best in early October, mid-October, right around Halloween time. You also find things like puffballs at that time of year, which are also good. They're big, round, firm, white mushrooms, and you can slice those up and make like lasagnas, and I even make mushroom marshmallows out of those. I cube them and then deep fry them, and then sprinkle them with a little bit of truffle oil, and they're just like explosions of mushroom. Yeah.
Wow.
Mm. One more for you?
Yes, please.
It's hot.
Gosh, that's good.
Coming up, another recipe using chicken mushrooms, this time deep fried. Then Hannah Lenchek and Kevin Whittem didn't have access to land when they hatched a plan to start a composting business. We'll hear about the partnership that made it all possible. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated. Now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb, taste matters, your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. You're with Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Okay, I'm Ryan Johnson. I'm a sous chef at Farm Bloomington. So today we have some chicken in the woods mushrooms. These are brining in seasoned buttermilk. I've got, for about a pound of chicken in the woods mushrooms, I have 3 cups of buttermilk, 2 tablespoons of salt, and then about a tablespoon of pepper and a tablespoon of paprika and a teaspoon of cayenne pepper. But you can season it however you want to. And alternatively, to make this completely vegan and just as good, you could brine the mushrooms in straight pickle juice. A lot of really, really good fried chicken is done in pickle juice. So it's a great alternative if you want this recipe to be completely vegan. So what we've done first is we've rinsed the mushrooms off, and we've removed the woody bits of the stem where the mushrooms attach to the tree. So once we do that, we'll take them and brine them, and then we'll pull them out of the brine and just dredge them up in flour. If you're like me and you like your fried chicken or fried mushrooms extra crispy, you can take them and pull them out of the dredge, sort of shake off the excess, and then dip them back in buttermilk. And we're gonna sort of double bread them. All right, so once we got that, and this flour is just seasoned really simply with salt and pepper, but you can put anything you want in there. So we'll shake that off, and we'll just drop it down here in our oil. At home, you could do this in up like an inch in oil in a cast iron pan. And they like to float, so you can just sort of weigh them down like that. These look. We'll give them a little bit more time, but you can see they look almost like a fried chicken patty or something.
What do you say to people who are just, I will not eat any mushroom ever?
This is one of the best ones to get those people to convert on. They're not what you would consider or what you would think of when you think of a mushroom. It's just a really meaty texture. Like, they're almost exactly like chicken. All right, so these are about where I want them. We'll go ahead and, today we're gonna serve this on a sandwich with a little bit of tangy horseradish slaw and some sweet pepper relish.
Yeah, that's nice and crispy.
Yeah. And the little orange from the mushroom is coming through.
Yep. If you want to see that more, that is one of the advantages of a single dredge. If you dredge it one time, then you can still see the mushroom through the breading, which it's a nice presentation. But I like it extra crispy. All right, and of course we have to have a pickle with any fried chicken or chicken mushroom sandwich.
This sandwich is gorgeous. Photos and the recipe at eartheats.org. Indiana has a shortage of farm veterinarians, and that strain could get worse in January. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek reports, new rules for food animal antibiotics will mean more demand for vets in rural Indiana.
So these cans are just a few weeks old.
It's just before 8 a.m. at Luann and Tom Troxell's LaPorte County Dairy Farm, but the first part of the day is almost over. The cows have been milked, and the last calves are being fed.
Yep, they're getting milk, real milk.
The Troxells run this dairy and an old-fashioned farm veterinarian business. Luann's administration and Dr. Tom is the vet. Now he's getting in his truck to make house calls. The first is 40 minutes away.
At one time, I would have gone by six dairies to get to this one dairy here. And now I went by one dairy to get to these six.
Tom works for small farms, since big food companies often employ their own vets. And with consolidation in agriculture, the little guys are getting fewer and farther between.
Needs more windshield time, which isn't billable. And besides that, we've always tried to educate our farmers and teach them how to do what we do and how to make a right diagnosis. And now the farmer has the tools and the ability to do that himself. See, now these people here are survivors.
We're pulling up to J&S Dairy in Pulaski County, one of those last few small farms. It's owned by Mike Weldon's two sons. He says these days, vets like Tom are hard to find.
There's a lot of vets, but none of them want to do large animals. They all want to do dogs and cats. That way everything can come to their office and they don't have to drive around the country.
It's also about money. The average starting salary for a doctor of veterinary medicine in the U.S. was $71,000 last year. But average student debt was more than twice that. And equipment, medicine, and licenses can get expensive in rural places where there aren't many clients. But Indiana State Veterinarian Brett Marsh says it's still important to everyone to have them there.
Well, one of the things that we rely heavily upon a private veterinary practitioner is they're the eyes and ears for events that are going on in animal populations throughout our state.
He's talking about disease outbreaks like 2015's avian flu. But in 25 Indiana counties, there are no food animal vets at all. So the 200 or so that live everywhere else have to drive a lot. In January, they'll need to drive more. With new antibiotics regulations, they'll have to do more inspections and write prescriptions for drugs that farmers used to get over the counter.
Which then may mean that more vets are going to be needed by an area which may have been surviving just fine with one.
Danielle Tack works for the USDA. Her program identifies rural vet shortage areas. Indiana's are in the southeast and west central regions, and pays off some student loans for vets who set up shop there. They've picked six Hoosier vets in 5 years, and Tack says their funding isn't likely to increase. That means things won't change for folks like Tom Troxell anytime soon. We left him at J&S Dairy doing some very hands-on cow ultrasounds. This is a messy, smelly job. Tom's wearing boots, coveralls, and a plastic glove all the way up his arm. The cows keep crowding together as he tries to get one into a metal pen to do the ultrasound. Sparing you the gory details, it's not that bad, and it's not long before the cows get to mosey away again to eat lunch in their sunny yard. Farmer Sam Weldon says sometimes Dr. Tom finds a sick animal when he visits. Other times, he just tells them they're doing a good job.
That we like seeing Doc once a month.
But Tom has to get back on the road to his next appointment. He's got many miles and cow ultrasounds ahead of him. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Have a great day.
The story comes from IPB News, Indiana Public Broadcasting's statewide network, See more stories by Annie Ropeek at WBAA.org. Now we meet Hannah Lenchek and Kevin Whittem of Crosstown Compost. And I guess we could call this story No Land, No Problem. I met them on a stormy spring afternoon. It isn't raining yet, but the clouds and the wind are threatening. They hop out of their red truck. Hannah jogs to the house with a white bucket on its porch while Kevin pulls back the tarp in the bed.
Basically, it's kind of like just regular trash pickup. You leave your stuff outside. You don't really have to interact with us at all. You just leave your bucket outside. We come dump it in our truck, and then we clean it out and give you a clean bucket for the next week.
They pick up kitchen scraps from customers. In a compost heap, these are the green materials.
Looks like some orange peels, some tulip leaves, apple scraps, eggshells. Is this good? Food waste? Is there such a thing as good food waste and less than good food waste? Yeah, this is good food waste. This is produce food waste and eggshell food waste, which is what worms love and what microbial life loves. Bad food waste for compost would be like meat or dairy or oils, things that either break down really slowly or tend to have a lot of bacteria on them, like bad bacteria rather than the good soil bacteria, or things that will sort of attract pests to a compost pile. So yeah, this stuff looks great.
We are pulling back the tarp, that way we can add our food waste to it. That's a good looking potato right there.
Kevin and Hannah are in their mid-20s. They've been friends since their high school environmental management class. Their idea for Crosstown Compost started like so many big ideas do, over beers.
We actually were joking about starting a bagel company, like a bagel cart to sell just around town, steamed bagel sandwiches, and realized promptly that we had none of the skills to put that business together. But it made us think about what skills we actually did have, I think, and because we've both cared about sustainability for a long time.
And I'd say it just kind of snowballed into like a business that we thought that would be like effective in this town.
Bloomington, Indiana has no citywide food waste pickup program. They knew about some spots around town where residents could compost, but those areas can't handle a lot of waste. Not to mention that food waste is now a national topic of conversation. According to the United Nations Environmental Program, organic waste is the second highest component of landfills.
Even in households, and I think that households are sort of the last one because people don't, it's not the most overt form of food waste. You know, people think, well, I ate all of the flesh off of that pepper, but you don't think about like, oh, well, the top of that and the seedy part inside and the little bottom part, what happens to that?
She thought if they could collect enough food waste from local households, they could turn it into compost, which they could turn around and sell to gardeners. Hannah saw an opportunity.
When we sat down and started to think about really seriously getting into the business, the first thing that came up was where would we do it and needing land. From that, I started thinking about farmers that I knew that had some extra space and that might be willing to sort of rent it out to us. And Megan immediately came to mind.
I'm Megan Hutchison. I have a local homestead on the east side of town near Unionville, Indiana. And I've been working with Crosstown Compost.
When Megan was the manager of the local Growers Guild, Hannah was her intern.
And when I learned that she was starting this compost business, I thought, well, I have extra land on my property, and why not help this young person out?
Megan's land is basically a big rectangle.
Essentially, there's the house and a greenhouse at the front of the property, and then you keep walking back the length of the rectangle, and you'll see a garage, and then there's a big white barn, and right in front of the barn is where the compost is set up. And so they can easily drive up their truck, unload, reload. It's pretty simple.
She did some research to see how other farmers made agreements to share their land. She referenced an online service called Farm Commons when writing up the contract. In her experience, there are plenty of landowners out there who are willing to share their land in this way.
I mean, when I was the manager of the guild, we had folks all the time saying, I have this piece of property. If you know of anyone, a young person that needs land, here, let them know. But I think the harder part of it is the investment still that it takes. Even if you do have land, there's equipment, there's supplies, there's labor and time.
The cost of operating Crosstown Compost for Hannah and Kevin is pretty minimal. They have a truck for which they have to buy gasoline. They have to purchase browns like straw and dead leaves to combine with the food waste to make the compost. They pay Megan a small fee to use the land, and of course they both put in time and energy. Megan says a business like theirs is perfect for this sort of land share arrangement. But if you want to start a homestead, it might be a better bet to do what she did, save money, and then buy your land.
If your business requires a lot of infrastructure and you don't have a long-term agreement with the landowner, then that can be, you can be a little nervous about doing that because you're investing all that money. If you have something like theirs, which is fairly movable and replicable in a different location, then it's totally feasible.
Logistics aside, Hannah has one thing in spades, and that's passion.
I'm trying not to get too excited because this is like the thing that I feel most passionate about. I'm trying to keep it at least to a reasonable tone. But yeah, it's incredible. Compost is the greatest. It is literally the greatest thing you can put in your garden. Not only does it have all of the minerals and the nutrients that gardeners traditionally think of as wanting their plants to get, it also has just this whole crazy range of microbial life. So you're not only sort of refreshing the nutrients in your soil, but it's also like, it's like giving your gardens a probiotic.
It's not raining, which is a big plus because I thought it was maybe going to.
Back on the pickup route, she's washing out the bucket. Customers pay $7.50 a week to get their kitchen scraps hauled away. They can then buy a 5-pound bag of compost made from that food waste for $16. This particular bucket needs an extra strong rinse to remove all the coffee grounds. Anna says the right amount of coffee grounds is good for a compost heap.
It is pretty acidic, so if you get a large quantity of it, it can sort of mess with the pH of your compost pile. But on the upside, worms love it. Worms actually need a little bit of grit to help them digest stuff, so like eggshells or coffee grounds are really good.
She runs the bucket back up on the porch, and then they're off to Megan Hutchison's place to deposit this in the compost pile. There's more to see with this story at eartheats.org. If you're looking for compost tips and tricks, we've got that on the website too. From Twitter to the website to the podcast, our crew makes it all happen. Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. The executive producer of Earth Eats is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal, food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. And from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. A big thanks for spending some time with Earth Eats today. Hope to see you again. I'm Annie Corrigan.